Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's July 28th, and this is the second oral argument of our morning in the case of Lariat Companies versus Barbara and Michael Wickley. The panel before you includes Judge Diane Breckbald, Judge Lucinda Jessen, and Judge Michelle Larkin. I would note that Judge Larkin is joining us over the phone because she was having some internet difficulties. So even though we are all here via WebEx this morning, our regular rules apply. Each party gets 15 minutes for their argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll get an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you look on your screen, if you have the grid view, you will see that there is, we have our marshal who's keeping time, so that will be before you. If you have technical difficulties during the argument or your screen freezes for a period of time, let us know. You know, we want to address that and make sure everyone gets the full amount of time. Those of us who you can see, if we have questions, we may interrupt as we might normally do, or raise our hand to try and catch your attention, and Judge Larkin will just do her best to make sure that she gets her questions answered as well. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Brueggemann, and I represent appellant Barbara Wickley this morning in this matter. We are requesting reversal of the district court judgment against her in an amount in excess of $800,000. Your Honors, I've personally had a roughly 15 years experience in fraudulent transfer cases in various capacities with the United States and with bankruptcy trustees here in the Twin Cities. Usually I'm sitting where Mr. Warner's sitting about 85% of the time. This case has unique circumstances that I have not seen in various fraudulent transfer litigations, and the district court here erred by simply disregarding them and proceeding to make the Minnesota Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act essentially a cudgel of punishment as opposed to the tool of creditor recovery that it is supposed to be, and which functions that appellant are ultimately fulfilled in this case. The list of circumstances, Your Honor, that make this case so unique. Appellant as transferee paid a vast majority of these transfers to other creditors of the transfer, Michael Wickley. In fact, they were co-plaintiffs with respondent at the commencement of this case. There's substantial evidence of Mr. Wiggly's solvency in this case, such that the bankruptcy court in his Chapter 11 found that he was solvent when he filed just a few years later. The respondent's president himself has testified as to Mr. Wiggly's solvency. The transferor had debt issues, but they were not insurmountable or hopeless. In fact, he paid all his creditors, settled claims, and eventually filed and proceeded on a successful Chapter 11 reorganization plan, including paying respondents it's a federally capped landlord claim. And really what we're here arguing about, continuing to argue about in this case, is over recovery of a disallowed claim in a bankruptcy case. The respondent has been paid between Mr. and Mrs. Wiggley approximately $1 million to date. And ironically, Mrs. Wiggley, appellant's liability at this point will be greater than Mr. Wiggley's liability, since his liability was capped as a lease guarantor. This is a fraudulent transfer case, Your Honor. The Minnesota Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which has been amended over the years as the primary source of statutory authority, the Minnesota Supreme Court has provided some recent case law in the last 5 or 6 years on that statute, namely the Citizen State Bank case and the Finn versus Alliance Bank case that we discussed in our brief. Broadly, the MUFTA, as I'll refer to it, is an alternate collection remedy to enable creditors to collect debts against a transferor. It's akin to a garnishment against someone else who's holding property related to that transferor. The purpose of MUFTA is to restore property to the transferor's creditors. It engages in a transfer by transfer approach, and it is not a penalty statute, and it's not a punitive statute. The two orders on appeal are the original 2013 judgment, where the district court avoided transfers of three assets. That was Spell Funds 2, which was for approximately $412,000, Spell Funds 3, which was approximately $358,000, and a household bank account which had a balance on the date of transfer of $10,000. The total original judgment and then as amended was approximately $795,000 against appellant. And second, the second order on appeal is a 2016 amendment to that judgment, which provided a slight adjustment in the amount and also rejected appellant's arguments for equitable relief based on Mr. Wigley's successful Chapter 11 reorganization, whereby he paid respondent's claim, capped claim, and received a discharge. The three errors I'm going to focus on today, Your Honors, is the district court's ignoring of appellant's use of funds to pay other on-par creditors, the insolvency errors of the district court, and the district court's ignoring of the bankruptcy issues and equitable circumstances. Just given time restraints, I'm going to not discuss other portions of the briefing, such as the marital presumption and some of the absence of other badges of fraud. We'll rest on the briefing for those issues. Turning first, counsel, Your Honor.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. Can I ask two quick questions before you go further with your presentation that relate to your sure. presentation? The first is you indicate that appellant has paid other creditors, but appellant has not paid anything to Lariat, right? Those other creditors did not include Lariat?
In her Chapter 11 plan, so in 2018, she paid $330,000 approximately to Lariat. Lariat then had to repay that when the bankruptcy appellate panel later that year extinguished the claim in whole. In 2020, the Eighth Circuit reinstated the claim, and Mrs. Wigley has paid $361,000 to Lariat. And part of the transfer—
Is that part of our record in this case?
We filed supplemental briefing in the when the Eighth Circuit reinstated the claim that would have addressed that.
Okay. But it's, all right. And in terms of liability being capped, doesn't the decision of the Eighth Circuit cap your client's liability for rent damages as well?
It does cap it as an allowed claim, and it references the federal bankruptcy code as setting that claim to prevent landlord windfalls, given state court mitigation of damage rules are sometimes harsh for tenants and guarantors. Right. But because there's a non-dischargeability issue still, it's respondent's position that it can continue collecting outside of bankruptcy court on that disallowed amount.
Right.
One of our arguments,
as it stands, the recovery is capped at $308,805, correct?
That principle, I think the actual number as the allowed claim in the bankruptcy case is $361,000.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks. You may proceed.
Sure. And just since you raised that question, it is our position on the bankruptcy equitable grounds, seeing how my time's ticking down quickly here, that the district court should consider that cap, the discharge, the payment in the equitable considerations and the changed circumstances under Rule 60, as well as MUFTA's has language itself affording courts to consider equitable circumstances. The district court erred in believing that these issues have been dealt with in a substantive matter by the bankruptcy court when this matter was brought to the district court's attention on the motion to vacate in 2016. The Eighth Circuit later, though, clarified, and we cite this in our brief, that nothing in the bankruptcy court's order prevented appellant from arguing in state court that respondents' rights had been modified by the bankruptcy. The district court over-relied on believing that the bankruptcy court had in some way granted Lariat's substantive rights when, in fact, it just said you can go back to state court and argue. And so on the bankruptcy issues, we don't believe the state court gave due consideration to the merits of the equitable claims, believing that those issues had largely been discarded at the federal level, which they weren't. Turning back to ignoring payments to creditors, it is undisputed that a year after these transfers were made, the spell funds, as they became liquid through distributions, Mrs. Wigley paid $670,000 to the original co-plaintiffs in this case, Bremer Bank and Home Federal Savings Bank. It's our contention that those payments have three consequences under the law. First, they provide a measure of reasonably equivalent value in exchange for the transfers that should all but eliminate the constructive fraudulent transfer claims. They should dilute any badges of fraud analysis as to the actual fraud claims, and they should provide grounds for equitable relief at a minimum in adjusting the judgment. The district court disregarded these arguments by stating that because they're, by relying on the fact that there is a year time between when Mrs. Wigley received the spell transfers and when she made the payments. This is legal error though, because those spell funds assets were limited partnership interests. They had no immediate liquidated value or ability to be paid out to creditors. When they began to become liquid in early 2012, that's when settlements were made with Bremer and Home Federal, and they began to be paid out at that time. It's inequitable to hold Mrs. Wigley essentially doubly liable for settlements and payments she made to co-plaintiffs of Lariat in the first instance here. The badges of fraud is a non-exclusive list. The district court can consider any factors it wants. And this mitigating circumstance of a creditor using the transferred assets to pay creditors, something I haven't seen in this sort of formulation, really should grant relief, at least in part, at least in a credit for those payments that were made before the judgment was even entered in this case. It was wrong for the district court weighed that circumstance improperly, taken in collection with the other circumstances, such as that Michael Wigley retained substantial assets. There was no concealment or absconding of assets. There's a lack of badges of fraud, particularly with this element to support the judgment. And we cite to some federal law in this recent supplemental brief. It was an In Re DeBerry case, which is a Fifth Circuit case, holding that under federal law, which is basically on par with the elements of a state fraudulent transfer law, the return of property to the transferor would alleviate the transferee's liability. Well, here, appellant did one better. She actually returned the property directly to Mr. Wigley's antecedent creditors, creditors who had accelerated claims on par with Lariat in approximately $1 million, I believe. And so this mitigation should overwhelm whatever other badges of fraud the district court found to relief. Next, Your Honor, I want to discuss the insolvency, which, again, the numbers and the data and all our equations for insolvency are in the brief, so I'm not going to dig too deep into the numbers, but just point out that the insolvency finding here was based on a razor-thin margin of $178,000 by respondent's expert, Ms. Frances Michalski. The district court did not perform its own quantitative analysis in any regard. It just adopted her opinion wholesale. We highlighted significant flaws, over $1 million of flaws in her $178,000 calculation, and two of which are liabilities that it's just obvious. Starting with a Home Federal debt. Now, Home Federal was one of the creditors that got paid as an original co-plaintiff and settled. Ms. Michalski gave Home Federal a debt of $600,000, which was taken off a financial statement the Wigleys had made at some point in time. Now, that was at one point most likely Home Federal's original claim, but as an equipment lessor, it had the right to recover its equipment from the Baja Sol lease. And at some point it exercised those rights. And at the time of these transfers had filed an affidavit in a collection suit against Mr. Wigley for just over $400,000. And it amounted to a roughly $250,000, $240,000 error. The court does not have to give deference to an error that's at odds with an affidavit that had been filed with the creditor as a sworn statement. And that affidavit is in our addendum. Just swinging that $240,000 swing alone pushes Mr. Wigley into the zone of solvency, which again, a solvent debtor making a fraudulent transfer is not a common, if circumstance I've ever seen before in a case like this. In addition, the Wigleys had a Bremer mortgage on one of their assets, real property assets, that was in the range of probably at $1.6 million, and that's the number Ms. McCloskey used. However, at the time of these transfers, they were negotiating and settling that debt, and it resulted in a short sale without a deficiency judgment. They ended up selling and surrendering the property for $1.1 million, saving a debt claim there of $540,000. So just these two liabilities alone swings the solvency calculation nearly 900,000 or 800,000 into the Wigley's favor, just about the same amount of assets transferred. Your Honor, there's also the issue of, and I'm not going to, just given time, I'm not going to address the other three assets and liabilities that were addressed in the briefing, but again, the same types of errors. There were outside creditor documents or tax returns that gave a more favorable calculation to the Wigley's than the somewhat unaudited financial statement that may have not have been an appropriate use of time for. Okay, anyway, Your Honors. At the end of the day, respondent wants to talk about the big picture in this case and not get into a minutia, but we think under the big picture, we prevail under that standard. This is not counsel, just the garden variety. Yes.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin again, and I'm glad you said big picture because that's what I'm sitting here thinking, and I want to make sure I understand the big picture. So, and I heard you say that your client has paid Lariat something in the neighborhood of $380,000 as a result of her bankruptcy proceeding. Is that correct?
361, I believe, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay, so she's paid Lariat 361, and the Eighth Circuit has capped her recovery against or Lariat's ability to recover at 308.805 plus interest. So the question I have is, aren't there two different things at stake here? One is your challenge to the validity of the judgment that's on appeal and Lariat's ability to collect on that judgment. I mean, am I wrong in wondering how Lariat is going to be able to collect anything on the judgment if their liability is capped and they've already recovered that amount from your client? How's that going to work?
I would agree with that position, Your Honor, that that cap should be honored in state court proceedings. But given the timing of this appeal, I'm not sure that's directly an issue before this court. But yes, if it goes back to Michael Wigley's case for the same reason, his liability was capped. If they can't collect against Michael Wigley, why should they be able to continue collecting against his transferee? So yes,
okay,
we would agree.
Those are very good questions, but aren't those questions for another day? Because what you're asking us to do is reverse the judgment finding fraudulent transfers, which it seems a very different question than whether or not there can be collection on that judgment for other reasons based on things that have happened since. And again, I'm kind of going back to the notion of, I don't know, I mean, short of supplementing the record, we don't have in the record before us a finding that your client has actually paid Lariat the 361, which would discharge her obligation to them.
And again, Your Honor, the you're right about that subsequent issue in her bankruptcy is that there hasn't been a ruling at all other than the Eighth Circuit ruling, which caps the claim. We did bring at the very tail end of Michael Wigley's bankruptcy when it appeared he would complete his plan and get a discharge. We did bring, a Rule 60 motion on this fraudulent transfer judgment saying, okay, you know, debtor, creditor, fraudulent transfer. Right. Is a three-way relationship that's ongoing. At some point, if the debtor transferor makes good with the creditor, why should the creditor continue having an action against the transferee? So that was the basis of that motion to vacate that was filed in 2016 and is on appeal here. I see my time is up, so I'll just leave any additional remarks for rebuttal.
Let me ask the Mr. Brueggemann, let me ask the panel if they have additional questions. Okay. Then we'll turn to counsel for the respondent, and you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Warner. I think you're muted, sir.
My apology. Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. I'm George Warner. I represent the respondent, Lariat Companies, Inc. This morning, Lariat would respectfully ask that this court affirm the trial court decisions, and obviously that's both the 2013 decision of Judge Rosenbaum and then the later 2016 decision of Judge McDowell. This is really the third time a court has viewed the facts of this case, which my colleague, Mr. Brueggemann, aptly says are unique. In fact, that's an understatement. The facts are beyond unique. The four points I'd like to make this morning in oral argument are, and they go to the point Judge Larkin was making, there's been very detailed factual findings already, conclusive proof established in the trial court of actual fraud, point one. Point two, there's conclusive proof, to borrow that language from the Citizens Bank decision, of constructive fraud. Third, there's no legal basis to relieve Barbara Wigley of this judgment based on the discharge her husband, Michael Wigley, received. That's an argument made by the appellants in their brief. And then fourth and finally are the Rule 60 or the equitable arguments that Barbara should somehow be relieved from liability under this judgment based on the equitable considerations for the other facts that the appellant brings up. One of the points that Mr. Brueggemann focused on was the finding of actual fraud. And that actual fraud finding is based on a number of factors, only one of which is insolvency. And insolvency was established both in the 2013 and in the later 2016 proceedings by the examination of the expert witnesses by the trial court. And it's important to note that there were two...
Mr. Warner, if I may, before you dive into the insolvency analysis, I heard Mr. Brueggemann also say that, you know, the badges of fraud, they're not exclusive, and that the district court should have explicitly looked at the repayment that had been made as part of that overall analysis, and I assume he means then to not do so was error. Could you, as you're talking about the badges of fraud, address that argument?
I'll address that right off, Your Honor, because that's an excellent point. And it's one that I think is most striking and, again, ties back to the uniqueness of this situation. What Mr. Wigley did was to transfer $800,000 in assets to his spouse, Ms. Wigley. She held them for a period of approximately 1 year under the reach of Mr. Wigley's creditors because they were titled and transferred into her name. She acted as a safety deposit box, or kind of a place of safekeeping. And then a year later, Barbara Wigley uses those assets to pay selected creditors of Michael Wigley. And Mr. Michael Wigley tells Ms. Wigley who to pay, how much to pay, you know, how to pay, whether to wire or what have you. And the appellant comes now before this court and says, well, that's evidence of good faith. That's evidence that no one intended a fraud here, and we should relieve Barbara Wigley of her liability based on that.
Mr. Warner, if I may, is the fact that Mr. Wigley told her who and what, you know, what to pay, is that part of the record? I just don't recall seeing it in the trial court's findings, but this is a large record.
It's a very large record, Your Honor. I believe it's in the trial transcript, although I may admittedly be mistaken. There have been such enormous proceedings here, the volume of facts is difficult to have a complete comprehension. But I believe that's established in the record. And the problem with that argument, the fatal flaw in that argument, is at trial, both Michael Wigley and Ms. Barbara Wigley proffered only one explanation for the transfers. They had to rebut the presumption that these transfers are fraudulent because they're spouses. And at that time in 2011, under the law existing at that time, there's a presumption, and we brief that extensively in the appellants and respondents fight about it, but there's a presumption when you've got insider status or spousal status that those transfers are fraudulent. You need to provide a good faith, legitimate explanation for the transfers. And the testimony of Ms. Wigley and the testimony of Mr. Wigley to explain away that transaction was that they, as a couple, would revisit their estate plan on some regular basis or with some regularity to true up the two spouses' estates. They didn't want Mr. Wigley or Mrs. Wigley to have much greater assets than the other, and that's to maximize the tax benefits and ensure that their estate planning would be most efficient as possible. And what Judge Rosenbaum found was, to be blunt, that doesn't work. If your explanation for why you transferred the $800,000 to Barbara Wigley is to bolster her estate and balance out the two estates, and then a year later, you tell Barbara Wigley to pay the debts of Michael Wigley, debts she has absolutely no liability for, and he provides all the detail for her to pay his debts down, then she completely negates and undoes any possible estate benefit. And so Judge Rosenbaum said, in very judicious language, I discredit the testimony of Mr. and Mrs. Wigley. I discredit their explanation for what it is they did. In blunt language, in vulgar language, she called them liars. It doesn't work. Their explanation offered at trial makes no sense. But a year later, Michael Wigley then instructs Barbara Wigley to pay his creditors, but only those select creditors he chooses or he likes, not Lariat, because this is a battle between Lariat and Wigley, but rather his other creditors. So is that evidence of lack of fraudulent intent, or is that just extraordinary evidence of the fraud? Namely, you hold my money, you keep it safe from my creditors, you act like that safe deposit box or that, you know, chest where I put my valuables, and then I'll circle back later and tell you who to pay, who I want you to pay, for debts you have absolutely no liability to. Judge Rosenbaum saw that.
Mr. Warner? Judge Larkin, I'm going to interrupt because I think you've made your point there. I just, again, want to come back to this issue of big picture. What is Lariat's position regarding appellant's current liability to Lariat? In other words, what's the interplay of her bankruptcy proceeding and the district court's judgment and finding of a fraudulent transfer? Or is there no interplay? Is this just a situation where we should just be looking at whether or not the district court's judgment is sound and whether or not the district court abused its discretion by refusing to change the judgment based on bankruptcy proceedings, and that argument about how and whether those bankruptcy proceedings impact the amount Lariat can collect just have to be made at a later time? That's what I'm struggling with. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's admittedly complex. I'll do my best to try to explain it perhaps a little bit better or in more detail. In Barbara Wigley's Chapter 11 bankruptcy, Lariat was allowed to be paid a certain amount of money, that $300,000 sum, by operation of federal bankruptcy law.
Okay.
And very briefly, what the bankruptcy courts said, both on a trial and appellate level, was that this claim Lariat has against Ms. Wigley is considered a landlord claim. And so a complex provision of the bankruptcy code caps the amount that can be collected from Ms. Wigley in the scope and course of her bankruptcy.
All right. So then your argument is, we're not in bankruptcy court anymore. You've got the judgment for the full amount and you want to be able to collect the full amount. And presumably you wouldn't be trying to collect any amount that have already been paid in the bankruptcy context. It would just be the difference. Is that where you are?
Yes, but I want to expand on that, Your Honor, because there's an additional proceeding in the bankruptcy court. That is,
okay,
Ms. Wigley might well have only paid that $300,000 capped amount and nothing more, but there is an adversary proceeding in Ms. Wigley's bankruptcy, and that is a lawsuit within the bankruptcy where Lariat sued Barbara Wigley to establish that the judgment obtained against Barbara Wigley was based in fraud. It was a judgment that was, in the parlance used by the bankruptcy practitioners, non-dischargeable. And there was a two-day trial before Judge Fisher in St. Paul where Lariat had to prove that under the applicable bankruptcy laws, that the judgment it had obtained against Barbara Wigley was in fact a non-dischargeable judgment, that it had this character of being a judgment based in fraud, and thereby it be an exception to the general rule, which when you go into bankruptcy, you're going to be absolved of all your debts, so they'll be extinguished. They
right.
can't be collected upon you. But indeed, Lariat did prevail, and Judge Fisher found in some extraordinarily detailed findings that this had been a fraudulent judgment, and therefore it was going to be non-dischargeable. So how that all plays out is Lariat did receive the capped amount in the course of Barbara's bankruptcy. That must be credited to her under the existing state court judgment. The remaining balance of the state court judgment survives. It doesn't get discharged in her bankruptcy because of the fraud finding in the bankruptcy court, and Lariat comes back to state court to enforce it. And in fact, it is enforcing it or attempting to enforce it in trial court proceedings now. So the
that's very helpful, because what I'm trying to sort out in my mind as the appellate court looking at the district court's judgment, to what extent do subsequent proceedings in the bankruptcy court impact that judgment? And I'm thinking that the only way they could impact them would be, you know, on the Rule 60 motion, asking the judge for, based on things that have happened since the judgment, to set it aside. And we're really just looking at that for an abuse of discretion. But these issues of who owes who what, how much can Lariat collect, all these other things, those are for another court another day, correct?
Yes, and they may well have played out. So the status of these proceedings, Your Honor, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The appellant has come back to attack the validity of the underlying judgment. The substance of the judgment. And those are the first two or three arguments the appellant makes. And then, of course, as skilled advocates, they come back with a second layer of argument that, okay, even if the trial court's judgments are sound, use Rule 60 to undo them anyways for various equitable considerations. I think that's the status of these proceedings.
Okay, and then the equitable decision is discretionary abuse of discretion review.
I believe so, Your Honor. I think that's the appropriate standard for the abuse of discretion. There's an interplay of different standards that is, as sure. I've mapped it out, we have the clearly erroneous for the underlying decision or the factual findings. A couple arguments by the appellant are just invent new law, invent new law.
In terms of collection efforts, it's entirely possible, or perhaps it's happening, that appellant is making many of these same arguments in the collection proceedings, or some of the same arguments.
Well, I don't want to really speak to that, as I'm not the appellant, Your Honor. The appellant is using all the remedies available to them in the state court to deal with the collection efforts, but I'll let Mr. Brueggemann speak to that specifically. I think the case procedurally, however, is at a point where what they really need to do, and what they're obviously seeking this court to do, is reverse the trial court's decisions, reverse that judgment. That's really the one and only remedy likely available at this end.
Yeah. Thank you. Your answers were very helpful in terms of understanding sort of the lay of the land. Thank you, in the context.
Yes, Your Honor. I see my time has almost expired. I'll conclude unless the court has further questions. The respondent simply believes that both the 2013 and the 2016 decisions are extraordinarily detailed. They're very well written. They're amply supported by the record. There's simply no factual or legal basis to overturn them in any respect. And we'd ask that they be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Does the panel have further questions for Mr. Warner? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Warner. Mr. Brueggemann, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Judge Larkin, I think to just further clarify the comments on what's before this court and thinking about it through a timeline perspective, everything that occurred between these parties through, 2016, June, that sort of timeframe, 2016, as Michael Wigley's bankruptcy case was wrapping up, that's all included. All those circumstances that occurred through that time are included in that Rule 60 motion. That's I guess how I view it, as another way of. Just a few comments. The estate planning argument, I think, is a red herring, because the court has always said, well, since they paid the assets to creditors a year later, that means that the estate planning motive must not have been true. But the problem is, and then they say, well, and that just leaves the possible motive as defrauding creditors. The problem is paying creditors, if that amply invalidates any estate planning motive, it equally invalidates any motive that they were going to defraud creditors. And it wasn't a circumstance where they were holding money. These were limited partnership assets. I'm not sure if someone was trying to ask a question there. No? Okay. And so I think that the court's estate planning analysis, which it didn't actually provide any analysis or description of why it wouldn't constitute estate planning, balancing assets between spouses is a common procedure. And there's no discussion on that point. But at the end of the day, the fact that they repaid these assets to creditors, they fulfilled the purpose of MUFTA. The purpose of MUFTA is to restore property to creditors. These weren't selected creditors. These were Lariat's co-plaintiffs. These were the other two creditors who commenced this lawsuit. They had antecedent business claims against Michael Wigley on par and of even priority with respondents. The ability to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to these other creditors made respondents' job that much easier in the future, as it reduced the claims against Mr. Wigley and freed up his ability to use other assets to pay Lariat, which he did eventually in his Chapter 11 bankruptcy case. This is actually not that complicated of a case. It's been made complicated by the litigation overlaying the various facts. It's a case about someone who was struggling to get out of the recession with a handful of small business failures, but they were part of a much larger business portfolio that he had. He did not transfer substantially all of his assets. He was able to pay creditors with the other assets he had. This case presents a manipulation of MUFTA as a remedy. The original judgment stood on very shaky grounds, considering that the creditors did get paid, that these assets were not kept by Mrs. Wigley for her sole benefit. She did not further secrete them. They were all disclosed. They were all paid. Mr. Wigley was settling debts throughout the entire course of this whole dispute. The judgment was on shaky grounds to begin with, and following the completion of his Chapter 11 plan and meeting all his obligations under state and federal law, it is inequitable to permit respondent to continue collecting when it has been fully satisfied by Mr. Wigley of every obligation he has to them as recognized under state and federal law through the application of the bankruptcy code. So we would respectfully request that this court reverse and vacate the judgment of the district court, both judgments.
Any questions from the panel? Thank you, Mr. Anything further, Mr. Brueggemann?
No, Your Honors.
Well, thank you both very much for the, your arguments were helpful today, and the briefing was excellent as well. So we will take the matter under advisement, and an opinion will be issued within 90 days. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.